book of Esther, which we're looking through, and we got to chapter 2. And I guess this isn't a good chapter for those who are women's libbers amongst us. Perhaps the whole book is not good for that, but we've got lots of lessons I think we can learn from this story of Esther. So far we've been introduced to this book. It's unique, as we know, in the Bible, because it's the only book in the Bible that doesn't directly mention God. But it does clearly talk about God's providence all the way through. And even though God is not mentioned, we can see God working in tremendous ways through his people and through especially Esther and Mordecai in this story. We've looked through chapter 1 previously, which gives us really the background to Esther's story. We saw there, didn't we, King Xerxes, this great ruler at the height of his powers, really, well, certainly the height of the Persian Empire, and how he is rebuilt this, or finished building the citadel at Susa. Tremendous work that's gone on there, and his father Darius started that building, and Xerxes himself completes it. And when he completes it, he throws his great big party. He invites everybody along. He displays the wealth of his kingdom. He shows off, basically, what a great king he is. And then he has this party at the end for 7 days, where all the nobles and anyone who was anyone in the kingdom turned up to this party. And, of course, they're all getting drunk, and they're all having too much to eat and to drink. And, you know, there's lots of chatter going on. And eventually the king says, you know, I think you really ought to look at my wife. She's really good looking. And, what a wonderful woman I've got here. And so he sends for Queen Vashti. And, of course, and I can't blame her, she didn't want to come. She didn't want to come out to be ogled by all these men. And she refuses. And as a result of that, he gets into a bit of a paddy. And his advisors say to him, well, why don't you banish her completely? She's never to be seen again by the king. He says, what a great idea. And he sends out this edict and says, Queen Vashti is never to enter the presence of the king ever again. And those laws, the laws of the Medes and the Persians, could never be repealed. So he could never go back on what he said there. And that's where we've come to at the end of chapter 1, isn't it? Queen Vashti has been banished from his presence forever. And I suppose this week we come and we meet Esther. I guess for a better word, the heroine of our story. The one, of course, the book's named after, and the one that God is using to work his purposes out through this story. First thing I think we can look at tonight is the king who remembers. The first thing we read in chapter 2, really, isn't it? That later, when the king had his anger subsided, he remembered what he had said and what he had done. In his drunken rage and with some ill advice, he banished his queen, the queen Vashti's Queen Vashti. And I think he probably regrets his actions as he remembers what he's done here. He clearly thought a great deal of her to have her in that position in the first place. I mean, in his position, as we see, he had a harem, he had lots of women, lots of wives, many perhaps who'd been married due to alliances to keep peace with other nations or other countries, to make sure that he could maintain his position. And very often in this position, you know, a girl could come into the harem of the king and never be seen again. That's where she stayed for the rest of her life, and she might never have been seen by the king ever again or anybody else apart from the eunuchs who looked after the harem. And that was very often the lot of these girls who came into a harem like this. So to be in the position of queen, the one that he had chosen specially to be there, the one he wanted there particularly, she must have been a very special woman. And he clearly did think a lot of her because he wanted to show her off, didn't he, to all his cronies. So I guess he did regret what he'd done to a degree, that he banished her forever. He could never see her again. That was what he'd done. And we saw, didn't we, that there are consequences to people's actions. Last time we saw that the Queen's refusal to do what the king commanded her to do cost her dear. It meant she was banished and she probably would have been in the harem, and that was the last anybody ever saw of her for the rest of her life. But it also cost the king dear, because it lost him, if you like, this woman that he was very clearly, if we don't know about, in love with, certainly was very dear to him. And so the king's hasty and perhaps ill-advised decision had consequences for him too. And I wonder how often we make rash decisions that have undesirable consequences. I'm sure we've probably all done things in everyday life and wished we hadn't, making hasty decisions that give us consequences that we don't really want. Things perhaps we do in the heat of the moment. Things we say in the heat of the moment. And when you've said it, you can't take it back. You ever done that? Well, I know I have, and I'm sure many of us have done those sorts of things. We need to be careful, don't we, about the things we say, the decisions we make. We mustn't do things in haste and then not be able to go back on them. This is especially true when we talk of our spiritual walk, isn't it? We should always consider carefully what we do and what the results of our actions might be, especially in terms of our spiritual walk with God. We shouldn't make hasty and rash decisions. We should consider carefully all the things that God wants us to do. We need to make sure that we're walking the path God has set before us and not going our own way and doing our own thing. You know, God always confirms his will for us in our lives. And if we do something in haste, without really considering it or prayerfully taking it before God, we could be making a wrong decision. And that might mean we're not doing what God wants. And sometimes it can mean that we go the wrong way completely, and very often that has consequences of its own, doesn't it? We need to be very careful that the things we do, we take into account the consequences of those actions. The king didn't do that. He was hasty, he took bad advice, and he probably ended up regretting what happened. But we have to move on, and the king needs a queen. You know, the king's advisers are seeing what's going on here. They're looking at the king, and they can see that he's not at all happy with what's happened. And so they have this great idea about what should be done in this situation. They don't want the king to end up moping around and being no use to the kingdom. They need to get the king to move on, to gee him up, and to get him working again. So they figure he needs a new queen. I mean, he's got a harem full of women as it is, but no, he needs a new queen, doesn't he? So what do they suggest? They come up with this great plan to get the king a newer, younger model so that he'll forget all about Queen Vashti. And of course, when they present this idea to the king, he's quite happy with it. He's not at all averse to such an idea. And so he makes this edict, and he says, right, all the best looking girls in the kingdom should be brought to the capital so that he can choose who he wants to be his new queen, who will become Vashti's replacement. So that's the plan, and it seems to be something which has stirred the king's interest. And so that's what they do. The edict goes out, and throughout the land, these girls are brought to the king's capital. And then we meet Mordecai, one of the major characters of this story. Mordecai, we're told, is a Jew from the tribe of Benjamin. And we're given a little bit of his history. Clearly, he was born in exile, so he's quite at home in Susa. Yet he's still a Jew. He's still, in many ways, an outcast in that society. He's not a native. He's somebody who's been brought there after being conquered, or his people have been brought there after being conquered. And he is still really a bit of an outcast in that society. It was his great-grandfather, or Kish, who had been brought into exile by the Babylonian king, Nebuchadnezzar, just over 100 years earlier. And since then, possibly his grandfather, but certainly his father, had been born in this foreign land. And there are, in fact, records of this empire, and some of those records show there were at least 100 Jews residing in the city of Susa during the reign of Xerxes at the time we're talking about here. So there were a lot of Jews in that city, as well as in, of course, the provinces and surrounding areas who were still in exile from Jerusalem. Mordecai is his Persian name, and it's derived from the Babylonian god Marduk. He probably had a Hebrew name, as we see Esther does, as we'll see that in a minute. But we're not told what this is. There's an ancient tablet that was found near Babylon that mentions the name of a scribe named Mardukai, who was an accountant and a minister in the court of Susa during the reign of Xerxes. And it's thought this was in fact Mordecai, perhaps after the events of this story, and he'd been given a fairly elevated position in the kingdom. Now, why Mordecai hadn't chosen to go back to Jerusalem with the early returning exiles, we don't really know. Perhaps he was quite comfortable, quite happy where he was. I mean, let's face it, he didn't know Jerusalem as his home. All he ever knew was the city of Susa as his home. So he's probably happy to stay, even though the Jewish people are still seen as second-class citizens. But we do see here the providence of God, don't we? Because like Esther, it seems that Mordecai was placed here for a purpose at just such a time as this. And it's Mordecai's forethought and clear thinking that gets Esther into this position of queen, but later on ensures the survival of the Jewish people. It's Mordecai who had the idea. It's Mordecai who saw what was going on. And he saw this as an opportunity. When he heard the king's edict, he saw this opportunity to get his beautiful cousin into a position of influence in the kingdom, which he probably thought could only benefit the Jewish people. Also, as we'll see later on, he's clever enough to tell her not to reveal her nationality. If you look in verse 10, he tells her there, or he says that he's forbidden her to tell them that she was a Jew. And also again in verse 20, we read the same thing. So he's clever enough to make sure that she doesn't reveal her origins. A foreign girl as queen may not have been politically acceptable to the king or his advisers. It certainly wouldn't have been acceptable to Haman, who we'll see later on in the story. So Mordecai, in contrast to the king, doesn't make rash or ill-advised decisions. He clearly thinks about what he's doing. He's very wise and presumably a very godly man, as God is using him in this position. God knows what's going to happen. Mordecai doesn't, but he's probably got insight into things that are going on. And it's an insight that's clearly God-given. And God uses this man to great effect. Now, we don't know if Mordecai had any idea that the Jewish people would come under persecution and oppression. But he certainly thought it was a good idea to get Esther into a prominent position in the kingdom. I wonder if we have foresight in our relationship with God that allows us to be like Mordecai. Do we look for opportunities and make sure that we position ourselves to be ready for when opportunities arise? We talked last time, didn't we, about God is proactive, not reactive. And God wants us to be proactive rather than reactive as well. Are we aware of the situation around us? And are we proactive in doing what God wants in that situation? Do you know, for instance, the everyday issues that the people you meet day by day have? Are you aware of what makes them tick? What their situation is? What things concern them? What things they want to talk about? Do you know what those people think about Christianity? Are you prepared to answer questions that might come up? Have you done your homework? We were talking on Wednesday about Paul at Athens and the message he brought to the people there. And before he came and brought that message, he went around and did his homework. He checked up on what they believed. He looked into their society. He found out about their culture. And then he came and spoke in a prepared way. Are we prepared like that to speak to people around us? You see, it's not simply good enough for us to react in our faith. We have to be proactive. We have to be ready. And we have to take opportunities and even sometimes make those opportunities. That's what Mordecai was doing here. He was making the opportunity by putting Esther in that position. We've been looking at the armour of God, haven't we, in house groups? And we've seen the Roman armour wasn't just designed to be defensive. Certainly there's only one offensive weapon mentioned, the sword of the Spirit. But everything about about the Roman soldier was designed to move forward, not backwards. They were prepared for the situations they found themselves in. That should be our aim too, to be aware of the situation, the environment we're in, and to be proactive in making and taking opportunities for God. Esther gets pride of place, doesn't she? At last, we get to meet Esther here in this story. Her Hebrew name is Hadassah, which means, if you remember from when we looked at it earlier, the introduction, myrtle. And you'll remember that myrtle is mentioned in Isaiah, in the prophetic writings, where myrtle replaces the thorns and the briars. And it signifies God's forgiveness. And her name is significant of God's forgiveness. And he's putting her in a position where ultimately the Jewish people are saved through her being there. Myrtle branches are still carried by the Jews during the Feast of Tabernacles, which signify peace and thanksgiving. The Persian name Esther, which is her Persian name, means a star. And again, it's possibly a reference to the star-shaped flower of the myrtle tree. Anyway, here she is. And Mordecai has taken her in. She was an orphan. Her parents had died, and she was his cousin. I mean, obviously, he's a lot older than she is, and he's taken her in, and he's looked after her, and he treats her like a daughter. He's brought her up as if she was his daughter. And we're told here, aren't we, that she was lovely in form and features. Clearly, a very beautiful girl indeed. One who was likely to catch the eye of the king. And then we're told that Esther is one of the many girls that are taken to the palace to be prepared for the king. It's a bit like the X Factor auditions, as the girls prepare to go in front of the judges. But in this case, it's a bit of a longer process. It takes a whole year of beauty treatments, we read in verse 12, doesn't it? I don't know if any of you girls would need a year of beauty treatments. I don't think that's the case at all. But this is what happened to those before they could meet the king. A whole year of being prepared and having beauty treatments. And right from the start, Esther makes this really good impression on the chief eunuch, Hegai, who fast tracks her, if you like, through the auditions. And she gets the best food, she gets the best treatment, she gets her own servants to look after her, and she gets prepared to meet with the king. And I think we sometimes need to think about preparing for the king, don't we? You might think that's an awful lot of effort to enter the king's presence, to get a whole year preparing to meet with this king. And yet, they probably only had one chance. If they didn't catch his eye or measure up, they'd be out to the harem and that was it. They wouldn't be seen ever again. So, they wanted to look their best. They wanted to be their best. If that much care is taken for somebody to meet with a pagan king, how careful should we be when we come to meet with the King of Kings? I know it's not the same sort of situation, but we should prepare to meet with God, shouldn't we? Ecclesiastes chapter 5, verse 1 says, guard your steps when you come to the house of God. Guard your steps when you come to the house of God. Be prepared to meet with God. Don't just rush in aimlessly at the last minute, but be ready and prepared when you come to worship God. Do you prepare when you come to church? Do you prepare to meet with God when we worship together as a family of his people? Are you always in the right frame of mind to meet with God? I know I'm not. I'm always rushing around before the service doing things. My PowerPoint went wrong tonight. My printer wouldn't work at home. I had to do it here. Everything was going wrong. I'm rushing around. And then I'm thinking, look at the message I've prepared tonight. And there's me rushing around, not preparing properly. But we need to prepare to meet with God. You know, it's easy, isn't it, for us to be taken up with other things, rushing around, doing things before we come to worship, not really thinking about who we're coming to meet with and not being suitably prepared to meet with God. Do you take time purposefully to get ready for church? And I don't mean the clothes and the makeup. I mean, do you take the time to prepare to meet with God? Or do you just fly in at the last minute? Do you prepare during the week? Do you pray for the preacher during the week? I do when it's me, but I can't say I always do when it's somebody else. I forget sometimes, and that's not good either, is it? But we should, shouldn't we? We should take that time. That's part of the preparation of us meeting together. What about the prayer meeting beforehand in the evening? That's a good time to come and just quieten down and prepare to be with God. An excellent way to get into the right frame of mind. We need to prepare to meet with the King. What we see in these few verses at the start of chapter 2 here, in this story of Esther, is again, we see God working, don't we? He's not mentioned, but he's constantly working through this story. We see the preparations that are going on, where he's getting Esther into the place he wants her and needs her to be. He's using Mordecai to get her to that position, to encourage her. And we see there, don't we, Mordecai's vision. And that's the sort of vision we need as individuals, but as a fellowship. We need to be looking to what God is doing, not right now, but the next step. You know, God leads us a step at a time, but he doesn't hide it from us. If we're seeking him, he will show us what he wants of us. And we need that vision. We need to be proactive. We need to be eager to move on with God, to do what God's called us to do. And to do that, we need to listen to God. And to listen to God, we need to take time to prepare when we meet with God. Let me encourage you this evening to take that lesson to heart, as I hope I will. That we'll look to what God wants of us as a fellowship, that we'll seek his face and we'll seek his path, we'll seek his direction. And to do that, we need to come to God with the right frame of mind, the right attitude, eager to meet with him, eager to hear what he's got to say to us, prepared to honour him and worship him, prepared to glorify him, not simply to rush in and rush out. Mordecai had a vision. He had an insight, a God-given insight. He may have not, he probably didn't know all that was going to happen, but he knew he needed to get Esther into that position. And he trusted God to do that as well. Let me encourage you this evening to be proactive in your faith, to seek out the opportunities that God has for you. And God has opportunities for all of us. To even make those opportunities where we can. Not simply to react to things that come along, but to be ready and prepared to tell other people the good news of Jesus Christ and to be prepared when we come to worship to meet with our God.